south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came up to play. And now as I wander.
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started. And now we're going to discuss something I've never spoken about before on the air, since in the past I've reserved this little bit for my seminar people only. Now, as you might imagine, during the seminar, people can ask me everything and anything. And believe me, they do. And unlike on the radio show and the podcast, where there are certain things I can never talk about or I'll get in big trouble. Not so much from the bigwigs who are in charge of the shows, but from Big Brother. Who else? Like I need to be on another government list. I mean, really, I'm probably on 10 times as many lists as any of you guys are on. But I'm so far away and comfortably anonymous, which means I've got nothing, and I mean nothing, in my own name, which you could never pull off up in the first world, but down here it's easy. So, bottom line, as long as you remain a little fish, the big claw of Big Brother can't really do much of anything to someone who's 1,000 or 2,000 miles away from the homeland. So, as long as you have a tiny footprint and remain small potatoes, the NSA and Homeland Security and all those other alphabet agencies will just continue to pick on and harass the easy targets, the ones within reach. All you guys living up there within the borders of, quote, the land of the free. Anyway, one of the common questions I get in emails, and always comes up multiple times from people at seminar, is once a person's actually made it down to Latin America, permanently or semi-permanently, and once you've set up your SA corporations and bank accounts and such, and we've talked a lot about that before on the show. Anyway, once you've done all that, just how do you go about getting your nest egg down here anonymously or away from the prying eyes of friends, family, and Big Brother? I mean, really, there's no reason anyone has to know your business at all. And speaking of Big Brother, after those NSA revelations and that Edward Snowden thing, we all just have to assume the government knows everything. Everything you do on the internet, any email, phone call, text message, even photos, the NSA's got it all. And what that means is any capital or money that you transfer around from country to country will be a big blip on Uncle Sam's radar, right? Or is it? And of course, there are a lot of gray areas here. Things that are illegal in one country, but totally legal in others. The fact is, you'll have to come down to the seminar to get all the skinny on that. But I can tell you this. At my last two seminars, when that question came up, I told the attendees that one easy way to shift money and assets around, if not anonymously, at least the important part of the transaction will be anonymous, is if you converted some of your wealth into bitcoins. Yes, I said bitcoins. Now, bear with me a bit here on the bitcoin thing. At the seminar, I recommended one of the ways to move wealth around is with bitcoins, and then ship those things around anywhere you want, because that part of the transaction is completely anonymous. And sure, your purchase of the bitcoins will be registered, and by the way, all of this is on the up and up, but after that, where you send them, where they eventually land, is your business, no one else's. And that part will certainly break the chain of any prying eyes. And so what if there's a paper trail, or I mean, a digital trail, leading to your purchase of, let's say, $50,000 in bitcoins? Nothing illegal about that. And then, when your bitcoins landed, you convert it back into whatever currency you want, or keep them in bitcoins. And some months ago, whenever I mentioned that part, holding on to bitcoins, that was the part people found hard to swallow. That's when I'd get the deer in the headlights look. Now, you see, the thing is, when I mentioned this little Bitcoin voyage certain people might want to take, during my last seminar, July of 2013, Bitcoin was about at 70. And in fact, it had been hovering between 50 and 100 for many months, fluctuating not wildly, but rather slowly, never jerking around like a buzzsaw at all. And if you look at the historical chart on it, you can see that back then, anyway, if you bought it at 70, it'd hang right around that point for weeks at a time. So the trick is, if you were worried about the fluctuations in Bitcoin, you just get in and out within a day or two. Well, anyway, after I spoke for about 5 minutes on that Bitcoin thing, not giving any investment advice, of course, but just pointing out that it was a great way to break the chain of prying eyes, government and otherwise. Well, when I said that, none of my attendees actually raised their hands or tried to argue the point with me either way. But later on at dinner and during some of the boots on the ground segments, I heard all kinds of feedback from the attendees, all of them pretty much poo-pooing the idea of Bitcoin for any kind of use at all, saying, well, you know, the same thing that they're saying about Bitcoin right now. And by the way, as I record this show, Bitcoin's at about 700. That's 1,000% gain in 4 months, you know? But we won't let that influence us. We're just talking about moving money around now, not speculating or investing. And like I said, I don't give investment advice. I was just saying it's a good way to transfer wealth around as anonymously as possible. In fact, I can clearly recall sitting with one of the attendees the day after the final day of the seminar. He came right out and told me in a nice kind of way that Bitcoin was a play for idiots. And he told me he knew this because he'd been in and out of various markets, currency exchanges, and commodities and such for 20 or so years, and he didn't see Bitcoin as having any impact at all. In fact, he kind of laughed when I mentioned it. Then I remember saying to him, well, then why don't you just take maybe 10% of your nest egg, switch it into Bitcoins, and pick a destination, send it there, and then immediately transfer them back into dollars or yen or euros or whatever. Because, you know, one of the great things with Bitcoin is that there's only a 5 cent, that's a cent, commission on a Bitcoin transaction. At least it was back then. As opposed to the way regular banks gouge people when they do wire transfers. And PayPal is the worst of all. Seems like everyone I know except Elon Musk has a gripe with PayPal. And I know, you're saying Bitcoins could just as easily have gone to zero. Just vaporize, since they're an entirely new thing, a digital currency. But you see, the thing that I knew when I first heard about Bitcoin, when they were at less than $10 each, what I knew about Bitcoin that 99% of you guys out there couldn't have known, unless you were nerds yourself, is that when nerds and geeks are totally convinced about a new technology that the regular public hasn't even grasped yet, basically never even heard of, they're usually so far ahead of the curve that the rest of the world kind of just ignores them until it's on CNN and Yahoo News and the brokers are starting to talk about it. And don't get me wrong, not that I'm a card-carrying nerd myself, but having graduated from engineering school, I know these guys and I don't ignore them. I listen to them when they tell me something. So, yes, I admitted I have a lot of nerdy friends, and over the years, I had a lot of tips, especially in the early days, that I never took, like Microsoft and Apple, Cisco Systems, etc. Not because I didn't believe these guys were onto something, but because I didn't have any money. And when my nerdy friends call me up and say, hey, Johnny, you gotta get some of this Bitcoin stuff. Well, you know what that means. That means that when these guys get hot on something new and technical like that, it's time to jump in because the rest of the world has not caught on yet. And I'm telling you, these guys put their money where their mouth is, too. And Bitcoin is a textbook case. Now, you can call it a bubble if you like. If you look at the charts, it certainly looks like it. In fact, the charts on Bitcoin are doing something very strange. It's had 3 bubbles already. Now, usually one big bubble is enough to kill any product, scaring people away from it for years. Just look at the U.S. housing bubble. That blew in 2008 and may never catch up to its past heights, save for those synthetic markets like the one in Washington, D.C., your tax dollar at work, and special circumstances like Texas oil country and downtown Manhattan. But the fact is, 95% of the rest of the U.S. is never going to recover from that blown bubble. But if you pull out the chart on Microsoft or Apple or Tesla Motors, they all look like bubbles too. In fact, hasn't Apple jumped up about 5,000% in its last run? And if that's not a bubble, but we know it's not, right? Since Apple makes very cool products that the world is addicted to. And it's true, Bitcoins are jumping around all over the place. And a lot of people just buy for speculation and ride it like a cowboy. Now, I'm not telling you to invest in them. I'm just saying it's perfectly fine to transfer money around with them. That's pretty obvious. But note that because Bitcoin has surged so tremendously in the last couple weeks, and it's been fluctuating easily $100 a day, you don't want to get in and out of that game. It's too frantic. A day or two waiting for a transfer to go through will just eat at your nerves. If you do use Bitcoins to transfer money, just wait a while. It'll calm down and stabilize. Look at the charts and wait for the line to flatten out a bit for a couple of months at a time at least. For example, if Bitcoin hangs around a certain price, let's say 400, for a month or two, go ahead, get in, transfer your money, and get out right away. I know a lot of expats who have done that without losing anything at all except the transfer fee. A whole 5 cents. Ouch. But admittedly, that was before Bitcoin took off into the stratosphere in the last few weeks. So right now, using Bitcoins as a means of just transferring money, well, personally, I wouldn't do it. Like I said, wait until the line flattens out. But there's another very important point that I want to make about Bitcoin. Bitcoins are not just about moving money around anonymously, or as close as you're going to get to it anyway. And it's not about just speculating in some new technology that made a bunch of nerds with pocket change millionaires. The fact is, the big banks and investment houses are all pissed off about it. And they've been putting out negative press releases and dissing it like crazy. Which should mean to all you contrarian listeners out there that something's rotten in Denmark. And it's not the coins that stink, but the banks and their PR machines. And you know what big multi-billion dollar organization is extremely pissed off at Bitcoin? More than anyone else, these guys are furious. And by the way, I'm talking about a Fortune 100 company, with 95% of their profits being derived directly from Latin Americans and Latin America. That's why I'm bringing this up. And I'll bet you a Bitcoin you'll never guess who it is. Now, this huge company, whose very 150-year existence is so critically threatened by Bitcoin that they're having midnight powwows and panicky crisis management meetings to figure out just what they're going to do if Bitcoin refuses to go away. Well, the company is Western Union. And of course, we've all heard of Western Union, but you and I have probably never used it in our lives. Though for the 10 or so million illegal aliens living in the U.S., it's their main line to home. Now, listen to this. Western Union's publicity department put together its own glossy, glitzy presentation, and you can get it in PDF form, called, get this, The Dangers and the Hazards of Digital Currencies. Why? Because they'd like to see it just die on the vine. Now, in that presentation, they highlighted Bitcoin and the other digital currencies. Now, of course, you know there are other ones that don't have anywhere near the volume or the market or media presence or penetration of Bitcoin. So anyway, in Western Union's glitzy presentation that completely disses Bitcoin, all the other digital currencies too, they repeatedly hammer on its lack of liquidity, market adoption and acceptance, and the immature consumer interfaces, as well as what they call murky regulatory issues that need to be addressed before it will be ready as any form of international money transfer. And by the way, they already know that it's being used for just that. And that's why they're so very afraid of it. So Western Union has come right out and pushed the panic button because their wire transfer business makes up 80% of its revenues, the vast majority of which are $1,000 and under. And the vast majority of which are being sent by illegal Latins in the United States, and there's more than 10 million of them, at least half of them sending a payment monthly by, guess who? Services like Western Union. And of course, these little payments of 50 or 100 bucks or so are being sent down to their family members in their respective Latin American home countries. And Western Union's panicking because for the first time in their history, their revenues fell to 19%, down from 25% for the latest quarter. Now I ask you, how many businesses do you know that consistently boast a 19 to 25% profit margin? Credit card companies and casinos, maybe. I can't think of any other business that's legal. Now, as you know, those payments coming down to Latin America from illegals up in the first world are called remisas. I should correct that by saying not all remisas are coming from illegal aliens, but the vast majority are. And the Latins that are legally up in the States sending remisas down, well, those guys nearly all started out as illegal aliens, so you get the point. Anyway, payment processors, that's what they call themselves, like Western Union and their competition. Yep, they have competition too. Why wouldn't someone else want to get in the act, you know? Anyway, the fact is, they collect anywhere from 5 to 35% on every transaction. They're actually much worse than loan sharks, because a loan shark will lend you money for a period of time, let's say 30 days, then charge you 30% interest. But they're actually lending you their money. In the case of money transfer businesses like Western Union, you're walking in there with your own money already. There's no risk for Western Union at all. But still, they take a huge slice. So they're making up to 35% on a single transaction that takes about 2 minutes without risking any of their own money. So I'm sure you've figured out it's an unbelievably lucrative business for which a thing like Bitcoin was specifically invented to transfer money around without middlemen like Western Union or banks, along with ridiculously low processing charges. Now, if you do a web search, you'll find that Bitcoin transfer fees are, get this, about 5 cents. And then you might ask, what about bank-to-bank transfers? Well, it's like this. Traditional banks like Bank of America get 25 bucks for a domestic wire transfer, with another $12 or so fee on the other end for the receiver. And fees for international wire transfers are even higher. And by the way, to do that, you have to have a legit bank account there. That means you have to whip out a real green card or a passport, and they take your fingerprints. And you know, I'll bet you another Bitcoin that there isn't a single illegal alien up north that will go into a bank and let them take his fingerprints. But with those money transferring services like Western Union, well, you could practically whip out any kind of ID you want, including a college school ID or a library card. And there's nothing anonymous about those kind of wire transfers at all. So what can we learn from this? I'll bet you another Bitcoin that in the next 5 years, brick-and-mortar banks no longer exist. They won't need to. And I wouldn't go buying any Western Union stock either. People in the know are saying it's going to be another case of the rise and fall of Blockbuster Video. And by the way, did you know that every single brick-and-mortar bank in the United States has definitive plans to drastically reduce the amount of branches they have? Brick-and-mortar branches, that is. Except, guess where? In Latin America. There are huge first-world brick-and-mortar bank franchise expansions going on down there. And why is that? Well, that's because so very few Latin Americans count on or even trust internet banking. And what that means is your convenient neighborhood first-world bank in the mall is going to disappear and, presto changeo, reappear somewhere down in a brand-new mall in Bolivia or Peru. And here's another little prediction for you. The first international money transferring agency that starts doing transfers with digital currencies like Bitcoin, once they get the bugs worked out, they're going to be the next Starbucks. Because it's a fact that Latins are tired of paying exorbitant fees. So, once those Latin Americans up in the first world figure out how to use it, they're going to dump Western Union and the traditional money transferring agencies in a Mexican minute. And what's a Mexican minute? Mañana, of course. Enough said about that. Let's get on to some fun Latin American facts. Here's one for you. Did you know that the World Bank estimates that 80% of all that beautiful rainforest hardwood that's exported out of Latin America, you know, mahogany, teak, caoba, palo blanco, and a dozen other fine hardwoods that don't grow up north, but you find in the houses of the rich and famous up there. Anyway, the World Bank estimates that 80% of all wood exported out of Latin America is cut and sold illegally. Now, that's not to say if you see a huge truckload of wood rambling down the road, they won't have a completely legitimate permit for it. Because, you see, if they get stopped by the cops, that's what the cops will ask them for. So if 80% of the wood's cut illegally, how do they get the permits? Well, that's because 80% of Latin American government workers are corrupt, too. Though I'm being kind, I think it's more like 95%. Anyway, if you and I, for example, walked into any Latin American environmental or forestry department, at least their version of it, how much do you think it would cost you to buy yourself a permit? Well, lately I've heard that it's anywhere from $25 to $100 a tree. And if you remember in a past show, I mentioned that your average hardwood tree down here goes for at least $5,000. Anyway, just to let you know that a big, bloated, lumbering blunderbuss of an organization like the World Bank actually takes a look at stuff like that. So you might ask if the cops are so corrupt too, if you have a load of hardwood like that, why don't you just take your chances without a permit, and if you get pulled over, pay the bribe, give the mordida to the cops, because normally that'll work every time. However, the fact is, in lumber country, the cops know that a truck with 5 or 10 logs on it is worth a fortune, maybe $50,000, so they're not going to ask for $20 mordida, they're going to ask for more like $1,000 mordida. They know the driver of the truck has a hell of a lot to lose, including the truck, if he doesn't pay up. Well, that's why these illegal hardwood cutters find it so much easier to have someone on the inside they could bribe at the forestry office. Then it'll only cost them maybe $25 or $50 a tree. Anyway, nowhere near the grand the police will want in bribes if you don't have a permit. Oh, and by the way, another game they play with permits is to add a few more logs that aren't accounted for in the permit. Since the cops that might pull you over are so lazy, once you show them the official permit and the seals and the signatures, they just wave you right on by. Anyway, most cops wouldn't know a $200 pine log from a $5,000 mahogany one anyhow. So there's all kinds of musical permits going on too. Cutting out and transporting hardwood logs, mostly illegally, is huge business down here. And I've seen dozens of big trucks loaded down to the gills with giant hardwood logs, driving through the boonies at 2 and 3 in the morning. Now, what's that all about? Why, it's all about the fact that on that shift, most cops are sleeping. They just can't be bothered with pulling over a truck like that. Oh, and here's a quick story for you. One of the guys I know down here who works for a lumber yard, a Latin guy, of course, he told me that when the trucks come in from the boonies delivering logs, occasionally there'll be one hardwood log short. Up in the States, we'd call that breakage, right? Well, down here, they call that mordida, too. This guy said that occasionally, a guy driving a big truck like that full of logs out in the boonies will get stopped by the cops. Papers in order, of course, obtained illegally or not. Anyway, sometimes the cops will screw with him and his paperwork anyway, especially if the paperwork was issued in a faraway section of the country. So the scam here is for the cop to say, I don't like your papers. You'll have to go back and get them reissued. Now, what that is a direct invitation to a payoff. And when you're way out in the boonies like that, sometimes when confronted with that situation, the truck driver will end up slicing a big chunk of log off for the cops. The log itself is the bribe, the mordida. So the driver cuts a chunk off, and the cops and he throw it in the back of their pickup truck. And now they've got a sizable piece of wood they can take down to their local lumberyard and trade it in for what would be a month's salary to them. A nice round number would be $500. But, you know, that only works if the cops have enough gas to haul that log to their friendly lumberyard. But you get the point. There are hundreds of ways to do scams like that down here. Which, when you think about it, is kind of funny. Here you've got truck drivers hauling logs that are illegally obtained, with guys from the forestry department issuing bogus permits for money, too. Meanwhile, the cops are on the road trying to shag these guys down so they can get their piece of the pie, too. Oh, and don't forget, when it gets to the port of call and needs to be shipped out by boat, there'll generally be some bribes paid out there, too. So think of that next time you admire your fine mahogany hardwood dining room set. And while we're talking about some of the stranger unknown things in Latin America, here's another little piece of news that may or may not come as a surprise to you, but it certainly tells where the world is heading. Anyway, according to a Spanish-funded education committee out of the University of Madrid, 68% of adult Europeans over 18 who are not in a university read less than one book a year. And, for the United States, 76% of adult Americans who are not in university also read less than one book a year. And if that's not depressing enough, now for the pathetic Latin American statistics. Did you know that 96% of adult Latin Americans who aren't in the university read less than one book a year? So what's that supposed to tell you? Well, that just means it's not a good idea to open a bookstore in any country. Now, this might surprise you. The two first world countries with adults that read the most are Spain and Germany. Can it be more than a coincidence that this study came out of Madrid? Anyway, in Spain and Germany, only 60% of the population read less than one book a year. So does that mean that 60% of the adult population may have cracked open a book and just never finished it? Who knows? Even so, I'd skip the bookstore business idea. Since even with ebooks and Kindles and PDFs and Mobi, reading a book from start to finish is not a growth industry. And notice I didn't say reading one from cover to cover either, because ebooks don't have covers, only virtual covers. And speaking of Latins who actually read books, and there aren't many, I was at a party the other day with some so-called Latin intellectuals, meaning they read more than one book a year. Whoopee, huh? And believe it or not, this time for a change, I actually heard a very interesting conversation that wasn't a repeat or a rehash of something that I heard before from another gringo or something I saw on the internet. At least it sounded to a few of us other gringo expats who were present to be fresh and original, which is saying a lot for any Latin get-together, even one loaded with so-called Latin intellectuals, who are in fact sometimes so pretentious you just want to vomit. And for all of you who might be thinking, Johnny, how can you say that? You better have some proof for that. Well, I do, and plenty of it. In fact, they prove it every day. Like I said in a past show, they're the ones who treat their cleaning ladies and help like they're not even there, that they don't even exist. And I'm talking about upscale Latin parties now, not your neighborhood barbecues and get-togethers in middle-class Latin America. And it's funny, these intellectuals who write books and articles deploring the classist and racist system in Latin America are the same ones that pay their cleaning ladies $150 a month and treat them like second or third class citizens. Not to mention, they make them wear these demeaning, fluffy maids outfits that went out up in the first world with the Cold War and black and white TV. So the question is, when you get invited to these soirees, should you go or should you stay home? Now, like expat Eddie always says, what have you got to lose? They always have good food and great booze, and believe me, when you get invited to one of those things, you really get to see how the other 1% lives. And us gringos, by the way, we call it the bubble. Nothing to do with a real estate or financial bubble. We just call it the bubble because that wealthy 1% are living in a protected little bubble of bodyguards and maids and bulletproof cars. And if you're from the first world, it grates against you a bit. And Eddie, he's more of a go-with-the-flow kind of guy. So when he tries to drag me to these things, and when I do agree to go along, he's been known to give me a little pep talk before we go in. He'll say something like, "So, Johnny, don't say anything to get us uninvited, okay? I do business with this guy, so try not to offend too many people. Which means a lot of times I just sit on a sofa, surrounded by a bunch of pretentious Latins, and play along like I'm really paying attention. So, as to amuse myself, instead of listening to their mindless blatherings, I just smile and nod when necessary. Because what they don't know is that I've got an earbud stuck in my ear, and I'm stealthily listening to my iPod clone. That way I can listen to some real adult conversation, like Richard Martin or John B. Wells from Coast to Coast AM. Or maybe I'll just cue up an audiobook. So for me, at least, it's not a complete waste of an afternoon or evening. Now, note that when you've got one earbud in, you can still be half in or half out of the conversations going on around you, just in case by odd chance you pick up on something interesting. Like at this particular party. And it all started when one of these Latin intellectual types said to the other, "Don Julio, how long do you think it will take Venezuela to convert itself into an oil-rich version of Cuba? Because I know you agree that that's the path they're following." And the guy he was talking to said, "I think maybe 2 years and we'll see the results of that experiment. But here's my question. How long will it take Argentina to turn itself into a Venezuela? Because like it or not, it's on the same trajectory." And the other guy said, "Yes, I can see it. Argentina's already like a smarter, more worldly Venezuela, but without the oil. We'll see how that experiment turns out after they default once again. And they will shortly, mark my words." Then the other guy answered him by saying, "Well, then how long do you think it'll take Brazil to turn itself into another Argentina? Since all the economic and social indicators show that's what's happening there, too." Then another guy in the group butted in. And after hearing him in an earlier conversation, I knew he was a dyed-in-the-wool socialist and a University of Guadalajara, Mexico, social sciences teacher. I'll never forget that, because at that party, I heard him tell at least 5 separate people his impressive third-world credentials. Whoopee! Like I said, pretentious. He should have walked around with a neon sign. And by the way, public school socialists like him are just the type to get a lone gringo in the corner and slam him if they can. And Eddie and I, well, we were the only 2 gringos in the place to attack, so we figured he might try to set us up. And he did try. So he turned and looked at us and said, "I have a question for you guys. How long do you think before Mexico turns itself into another United States?" Then, after a good long pause, Eddie said, "You got it ass backwards, mister. It's the U.S. that's rapidly turning into another Mexico, not vice versa. Just ask any one of those 20 million of your illegal brothers who've snuck in." Then, after the guy's jaw dropped, I said, "Eddie, not bad. I wish I'd have said that, except you wouldn't let me, remember?"
South of the border, down Mexico way.
You've been listening to The Expat Files, living in Latin America, coming to you twice a week from somewhere south of the border. Email me, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And don't forget to check out expatwisdom.com to sign up for your free reports on Latin America. See you next time. Nos vemos. She was a picture.